No one will blame you for feeling like it's a pretty shaky time for America. On the new podcast, How to Save a Country, you'll meet thinkers, doers, and organizers who are working to make the U.S. a more democratic and just place. People who are connecting the dots between economics, law, and politics. Hosts Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute and Michael Tomasky of the New Republic bring you the good news and the big ideas that point to a less fractured, more stable, more equal future. Follow How to Save a Country on Apple Podcasts. President Biden meets his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping and shakes hands. In Egypt, Chinese and American leaders shake hands again for the climate.
I think these are two very important countries working together to make each other more ambitious.
Also on the show today, Iranians are fleeing to Iraq, and we have an update on the situation in northern Ethiopia. A ceasefire is in place, but the situation there remains dire. I'm Marco Werman, and imagine never filling up your car again with gas. The lithium that powers electric cars is concentrated in places like Chile, where some are dreaming of a continental hub for building EVs.
If we are able to produce next generation EVs in South America, then we could become a superpower.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad to have you here at the start of another week. President Joe Biden is in Indonesia today for the G20 summit, a gathering of leaders from 20 of the world's largest economies. The big headline happened on the sidelines of the G20 when Biden met with Chinese leader Xi Jinping. Biden opened the meeting expressing hope that China and the U.S. could work together.
Our two nations, we share responsibility, in my view, to show that China and the United States can manage our differences, prevent competition from becoming anything ever near conflict, and to find ways to work together on urgent global issues that require our mutual cooperation.
Those global issues include climate change, food security, and nuclear threats. The World's Sarah Birnbaum starts us off today.
The meeting went late into the night. It wrapped up at about 9 p.m. local time. President Biden arrived at a press conference afterwards looking tired.
How long did that meeting last? 3.5 hours. So we covered an awful lot of territory.
Including, but not limited to, the economy, the environment, the war in Ukraine, and Taiwan. On that one, the president had some good news.
I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan.
And he said twice,
I do not believe there's a need for concern of a Cold War.
The relationship between China and the U.S. has been going downhill and fast, says Evan Medeiros, who was Barack Obama's top advisor on Asia-Pacific affairs. In the past few months alone, China sent missiles flying into the sea around Taiwan. The U.S. put export controls on microchips, cutting off Beijing's access to advanced technology. And there have been fears that the two countries could end up in a war. So the stakes for this meeting were exceptionally high.
Both leaders had signaled before they were going into the meeting that they wanted to take the temperature down.
We need to find the right direction for the bilateral relationship going forward and elevate the relationship.
To reopen up the channels of discussion.
The world expects, I believe, China and the United States to be able to work together.
And sort of prevent what was a free fall in the relationship.
That said, there's only so much a conversation can do. Mary Kay Magstad at the Asia Society and the world's former China reporter says China and the U.S. have real differences. Differences that are deep, structural, and ideological.
The two presidents, the two governments, the two countries have very different ideas about what each of their respective roles should be in the world and what the other's respective roles should be in the world.
She says China wants to be the number one superpower. It wants to build a new global order based on Chinese values and national interests. And the U.S. has no intention of stepping aside.
I think there's increasingly a recognition, I certainly hope there's increasingly a recognition that coexistence is what needs to happen rather than a continuing level of tension that at times has skated dangerously close to conflict.
After the meeting, the White House announced Secretary of State Tony Blinken would be going to China for a follow-up, and the two sides would reopen channels of dialogue. Evan Medeiro says that's important.
Today, both leaders said, yes, we need to get talking again. Let's see if we can find a way forward.
He says something else was accomplished today as well, having to do with the war in Ukraine.
Both sides made statements about opposing the use of nuclear weapons and the threat of the use of nuclear weapons in the context of Europe. That's significant because that puts a little bit more pressure on Putin and Russia to take nuclear threats off the table.
Medeiro says the meeting between Biden and Xi seems like a success, but the true test will be in 6 to 12 months. What will the relationship look like then? For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The U.S. and China are the world's two largest economies. They're also the two biggest emitters of carbon pollution. So it was a major setback last August when China hit the stop button on dialogue related to a collaborative fight against climate change. That was after Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. Today, a glimmer of good news. China and the U.S. have agreed to go back to the negotiating table. Ani Dasgupta, head of the World Resources Institute, says the global community is breathing a sigh of relief. He joins us from COP27, the UN climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Ani, how important is this news that the U.S. and China will restart climate talks?
I think these are two very important countries working together to make each other more ambitious. That has a huge impact for all the other countries. And we have seen this before. We saw this before Paris. You saw that on the floor on the last day of COP in Glasgow, Secretary Kerry running between the Indian and the Chinese and getting the text together. So that trust does matter. So I think it's a really a sense of relief and sense of hope for all of us that this might lead to positive discussion between the two and encourage others, because simply because we need much more ambitious action.
Mm. The UN climate conference will draw to a close on Friday. Is there still enough time for this decision to have much of an impact, and we'll get more details on the ambition of these talks between China and the U.S.?
I very much think so, you know, because this week, which is the second week of the negotiation and the text starts coming out, this is a time for details to be worked out. And there are quite a few topics, I think, that is very much under discussion between the two countries that could really help to push the agenda forward. So, yes, I'm hopeful, to be honest with you.
So the U.S. Special Envoy for Climate Change, John Kerry, has been having some informal discussions with his Chinese counterpart, Xie Jinhua, on the sidelines at COP. What have you learned about those exchanges?
The kind of sticking point that will be discussed would be definitely the loss and damage discussion. Some of the text came out today, initial text. I'm sure 1.5 degree or sticking to it has been a discussion. India had discussed including oil and natural gas along with coal as part of the discussion. So this idea of sticking to 1.5 degree and sticking to the text that was agreed in Glasgow would be, I think, very much part of the discussion. So these are the kind of things I can think of. I personally think there is time for them to make progress on all of them.
I mean, as for that complex issue of damage and loss, weather disasters that poor countries have had to go through because of the emissions of countries like China and the U.S., how will the U.S. and China address damage and loss? Because China's not been supportive of it, and the U.S. has mostly been silent on it.
My own impression is that the United States is supportive of finding a solution to it. I think the difference is how far they will go during this week and what needs to be done after this COP between now. And I think the current language is 2 years. I personally went encouraging people, and then they asked me, including Secretary Kerry, to have deadlines within a year, and maybe for full resolution within 2 years.
Ani, you mentioned earlier how John Kerry and his counterpart, his Chinese counterpart, Xie Jinhua, they've known each other for some 20 years. Is there something about their personal relationship that should give us added hope today?
Yes, my answer would be yes. Their personal relationship does matter. And their social capital they have with each other for a long time, it does matter. And I hope that this signal would unleash that and they will start negotiating and discussing.
Mm. Well, at one point we saw how Mr. Xie affectionately clasped Mr. Kerry's arm.
Right.
I guess when it comes to climate change, we'll take any bits of optimism, right?
Look, they know each other. They are seasoned negotiators. They see each other all the time. And my own judgment is both of them absolutely want a successful outcome on these negotiations.
Ani Dasgupta is head of the World Resources Institute. He joined us from the UN Climate Conference, COP27, in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Ani, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A bombing in a busy shopping area of Istanbul yesterday killed at least 6 people and injured more than 80 others. Turkish police have arrested a 23-year-old woman suspected of planting the bomb. Officials say she's connected to the PKK, a Kurdish militant group that has long fought for an independent Kurdish state within Turkey. The PKK denies responsibility for yesterday's attack. Meanwhile, the explosion has renewed anger in Turkey towards Washington for its support of Kurdish groups in Syria. From Istanbul, the world's Duri Baskaran reports.
It's hard to know what to do the day after a bombing. You walk down the same streets you walk on every day. They're just a little quieter now. Parents hold their kids' hand on the way to school past clusters of policemen carrying rifles. The bomb went off just outside a clothing store on Istiklal Avenue, late in the afternoon as families finished their weekend shopping. Nassim Amin, a tourist from Israel, was there.
I ran from there to up.
He remembers running past bodies on the ground, seeing blood. He says his wife is still in shock.
But today better. We hope it will be better.
Among the dead were a mother and a daughter, a father and his 8-year-old child, and a married couple. Here, red carnations mark the place where they lost their lives. Zaliha Duha came to pay her respects. I was here with my daughter, and she wanted to go into a shop to look at a handbag, Duha says. Thank God we did, because that's when we heard the explosion. We just feel awful for the families, Duha says. I hope God gives patience to their loved ones. Shortly after the attack, Turkish officials pinned the blame on the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or the PKK. The militant group has waged an insurgency since the 1980s in Turkey's southeast, but has denied responsibility for the bombing, saying it's out of the question to target civilians. Speaking at the scene, Turkish Interior Minister Süleyman Soylu vowed to retaliate. He added that Turkey rejects condolences from the United States, which supported Kurdish militia groups in Syria to fight the so-called Islamic State, or ISIS. The message of condolences is like a murderer coming back to the scene, Soylu said. The U.S. Embassy in Turkey did not immediately return a request for comment. This morning, Turkish officials released photos and videos of police arresting a 23-year-old Syrian woman from her home in Istanbul. Police say the suspect confessed to the bombing while in custody, but that's little comfort to people who live and work near Istiklal Avenue. I can't work, I can't function, I'm just so sad, says Serhat Olmez, who works at a bar a block away from the bombing. I can't even walk near the scene. His mother, who lives in the largely Kurdish city of Diyarbakir, insisted he move back to his hometown. She doesn't even know I came in today, he says, but I have to work. In a stationery shop not far away, Hatice Sandal spends most days sitting far in the back, away from the street. I feel like this could happen again at any time, she tells me. Turkey went through a violent period of terrorist attacks between 2015 and 2017, when ISIS controlled large swaths of neighboring Syria. In 2016, the windows in front of Sandal's store were blown out when a suicide bomber targeted a nearby government office. Little by little, as the years passed, she had started to feel safe again. Now, all of those old feelings are back, she says, and that sense of safety is shattered. Not just for her, but for everyone who lives here. For the world, I'm Duri Baskaran in Istanbul.
Iraq is a refuge for some people who are fleeing Iran as authorities crack down on protests there. That story's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Today, the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, visited the newly liberated southern Ukrainian city of Kherson. In Kherson's crowded central square, Zelensky attended a flag-raising ceremony. Some of his close advisors and dozens of Ukrainian troops stood by his side. Later, Zelensky spoke to the media. He said he came to support the residents of Kherson, to support the people, despite the risks. Zelensky then said that he wants to show that Ukraine's leadership is truly returning and fulfilling its promises. Kherson had been under Russian occupation since March. The city was liberated last week when Russian troops retreated to the eastern bank of the Dnipro River, just a stone's throw away. When Ukrainian troops entered Kherson last week, they were greeted by throngs of joyous people. Residents chanted ZSU, the abbreviation for Ukraine's armed forces. They took selfies with soldiers, lifted them on their shoulders, and held signs that said, Kherson is Ukraine. The celebrations have continued for days despite the proximity of Russian troops, again pulling back only to the other side of the Dnipro River. Today at the G20 summit in Indonesia, President Biden commented on Ukraine's success in Kherson.
A significant, significant victory for Ukraine. Significant victory. And I can do nothing but applaud the courage, determination, and capacity of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian military. I mean, they have really been amazing.
Biden went on to say that in the winter months, things will, quote, slow down, that is, on the battlefield. Wet conditions, mud, snow, and freezing temperatures will make troop and tank movements difficult. When it comes to negotiating with Russia, Biden was clear. He said, quote, this is a decision Ukraine has to make. Today, Iran launched missile and drone attacks into northern Iraq. At least two people were killed and nine wounded. The targets were Kurdish-Iranian opposition groups that Iran says are supporting protests inside Iran. Those protests, as you know, were sparked by the death of a young Iranian woman, Mahsa Amini, in September. She died in custody after being arrested by Iran's so-called morality police. Amini, notably, was Kurdish-Iranian. Reporter Yasmin Mosiman is across the border in Iraqi Kurdistan, where she spent some time with members of Kurdish-Iranian opposition groups, including one relative of Mahsa Amini.
The last time Irfan Murtazai saw his cousin, she wasn't Mahsa Amini, a globally recognized symbol of the fight against Iranian state repression. She was just his little cousin, Gina. They were at their grandmother's in the Kurdish city of Sakız, Iran, about a year ago. The family got together and played a round of their favorite party game, Mafia. Players have to sniff out the bad guys to avoid death through a mix of careful calculation and gut intuition. Amini and her brother lost bad, he tells me, when we meet across the border in the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Murtazai teased her that her youthful innocence was no match for his experience in life. Amini, he insists, was smart and independent, but preferred music and dance to politics. He was heavily involved with human rights activism and imprisoned by the Iranian government for it. He thought he was the one who would face the brutal hand of the state, not his cousin. That was the last time I saw her, but the government kept watching me, so I fled, he says. In Iraqi Kurdistan, he joined the leftist Kurdish group Kamala as one of their hundreds of Peshmerga fighters. Kamala is one of the handful of armed opposition parties now based across the border, with sleeper cells back in Iran. It's unclear how big of an actual threat these groups pose, but Iran accuses them of being separatists and orchestrating the protests rocking the country. Kamala official Hassan Rahman Panaya slams this as pure regime propaganda. He doesn't deny the role Kamala and other exiled groups have had in organizing protests back home, but he says the energy behind the movement is organic and from inside Iran. It's a very, very fascist government, he says. And the people are fed up with over 40 years of injustices. He rejects the claim that they're fighting for an independent Kurdish state, saying right now all they want is an Iran equal for all, including its Kurdish citizens. Kamala is heavily armed, but he says that's for protection from attacks by Iran, rather than launching operations against them. Not many can flee Iran at the moment because of an added layer of security forces at the border, but I'm told some activists have managed to slip through. Many hide among friends or family who've already established lives here, still fearful of retribution from Iran. Others join these armed groups, often seeing it as the best way to protect themselves.
He's not answering? Or he's not answering?
Not too far away, my producer Haure Ali Najed and I go searching for a splinter group of Kamalas. They're said to be more Kurdish nationalists. We're told the latest round of protests in Iran has earned them some new recruits. We find their Peshmerga fighters, men and women, standing guard with AK-47s and chain smoking at the foot of one of the mountains.
In the back or?
When they learn who we want to meet, they pile us into the back of a Toyota pickup and we head up the mountain to the clandestine location where they're training new recruits. The narrow dirt road tightly zigzags up the yellowing mountain as we follow the path so many Kurds have taken. A few weeks ago, Iran launched kamikaze drones, the same they've sent to help Russia and Ukraine. The drones totaled almost a dozen buildings here. We're told they're on edge because drones were buzzing above earlier in the day.
I was worried about the drones, but not anymore.
The driving is going to fall out of the car.
When we reach the end of the road, we catch a glimpse of a group of Peshmerga further up the mountain. Their brown khaki uniforms blend right in with the rocky terrain. 28-year-old Mohammed Kurd comes from the group to meet us inside a half-completed concrete structure being built into the side of the mountain. The death of Jina Amini was like an explosion that echoed throughout Iran, says the young man, who was a protest organizer. He says people want an end to a government they feel does not protect them. If a girl goes out, we used to say that criminals are going to take you. Now we say the government is going to, he says. He was at all the protests in his hometown of Dirandera and took videos when security forces began opening fire on protesters. When footage of him at the protest aired on Iranian TV, he snuck across the border to avoid being arrested. He says he finally feels safe and satisfied now as a member of Komala, training for his role in a future free Iran. So does 20-year-old Paria Ghaisari. She grabbed her 10-year-old sister and also came to join Komala last month. What happened to Gina could happen to any one of us, she says, standing on a cliff with her back to Iran. With a hint of a smile, she says, it's too bad the regime had to kill thousands of people to prove they didn't kill Gina. For the world, I'm Yasmin Mossiman in the Kurdistan region of Iraq.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Inflation can be abstract. For Brits who love their big breakfast, inflation gets real on a plate.
The sausage, that's a Cumberland sausage, so it's very strong with parsley. It's got a lot of herbs in it. Fried egg, that is the traditional. The bacon is griddled.
Not to mention tomatoes, mushrooms, beans, and toast. The rising costs of the fry-up still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Lithium, chemical symbol Li, atomic number 3. Across the globe, demand for lithium is booming. It's a metal used in batteries for electric vehicles, e-bikes, electronics, and to store solar and wind energy. It will be critical for the planet's transition away from fossil fuels. In Chile, a country rich in lithium, extraction is happening and fast, but mining operations are also having some negative impacts. The World's TB Saisea reports.
Next stop.
Looking around on the Boston subway, I see cell phones, digital watches, e-books, and tablets. I'm holding a digital recorder. I've also got a laptop and a camera in my backpack. All of these devices have something in common. They use lithium batteries. In recent years, the global demand for lithium has skyrocketed, and it's expected to rise at least 300% in the next decade. That's no surprise for people in northern Chile. This is a lithium mine in the Atacama Desert, not far from Chile's border with Bolivia. Here, a machine is pulling water from the ground, pumping it into huge, shallow evaporation pools. The liquid is super salty, 10 times saltier than seawater, and it's called brine.
Bueno, el proceso consiste en extraer salmueras desde el Salar de Atacama.
Osvaldo Yáñez is a manager with SQM, a Chilean company that runs the mine.
El sol va entregando energía y va evaporando el agua.
The sun evaporates the water in these pools, he says, and the lithium becomes more concentrated.
El Salar de Atacama tiene las mejores condiciones para
poder evaporar. Yáñez says the Atacama salt flood has the highest solar radiation levels on Earth. It also never rains here, so the water in the pools evaporates quickly. It goes from turquoise to yellow in 18 months. Then the lithium is extracted from the liquid, turned into a white powder, and shipped to places like China and the US, where it's used to make rechargeable batteries. Lithium prices have hit record heights this year. That's good news for Chile's economy. This South American country meets about one-third of the globe's lithium demands. Nearby, both Bolivia and Argentina are developing their lithium mining industries as well. Experts say the resource will soon be a game changer for the economy of the whole region, which is known as the Lithium Triangle.
There's a huge opportunity.
Juan Carlos Zuleta is a Bolivian researcher who's been following the lithium business for decades. He says the real opportunity goes beyond just extracting and selling lithium.
We have all the mineral resources that are necessary to produce next generation lithium batteries and next generation EVs.
He's researching a possible association between six countries in South America to fabricate and sell electric vehicles.
My idea is basically to create a hub of lithium batteries and electric vehicles in South America for the regional market. If we are able to produce next generation EVs in South America, then we could become a superpower.
But lithium mining with those huge evaporation pools has downsides too. James Blair is an anthropologist at Cal Poly Pomona.
Yes, this is exacerbating what is already a major problem of depleted water in one of the most driest areas of the world.
Indigenous peoples in the region worry that these mining operations threaten irrigation methods they have relied on for centuries. Rudencindo Espíndola is an indigenous topographer and an activist with the National Observatory of Salt Floods in Chile. He says green technologies are good for humanity, but the price of producing them will be paid by Chile's environment. The question is, Espíndola says, how much damage is acceptable? Back at the mine, Osvaldo Yáñez says the company is working on ways to conserve water.
Todavía tenemos algunas mejoras que hacer en cuanto a la utilización de agua.
The idea is to extract lithium directly from the brine without having to evaporate so much groundwater. But Yáñez says this will take at least 5 years to develop. In the meantime, he says the trade-offs are worth it in the name of a greener future. As global demand for lithium keeps rising, though, anthropologist James Blair says consumers can do their part, too.
By encouraging battery recycling and really just reducing car dependency, which is especially a problem in the United States.
Right now, there are about 16 million electric cars on the roads of the world. By 2030, it's estimated at 350 million. And all that lithium will need to come from somewhere. For the world, I'm Tibi Saicea, Atacama Salt Flat, Chile.
Lithium will be critical to powering modern society for decades to come. To learn more about this resource, we're joined now by Elizabeth Connolly in Paris. She's an analyst with the International Energy Agency, where she focuses on energy, transport, and technology. I mean, there's this moonshot goal of electric car production, Elizabeth. E-bicycles are now huge, not to mention all our devices that rely on long-life batteries. How much lithium does the world need going forward, and is there enough on planet Earth to fill the demand?
Right. I think in terms of the demand, that can vary a lot depending on what type of batteries we see in the future. But I will say in terms of lithium resource itself, I think there's
technically enough for the foreseeable future, certainly until 2030. But I think, you know, the real constraint is the supply chain, and in particular, the mining capacity for lithium.
I think of all the electric vehicles I'm seeing these days. Could the world run out of lithium by 2030?
No, I don't think by 2030 we have a problem with lithium availability. I think what's critical is that we invest in new lithium mines, because opening a mine has a lead time anywhere from 5 up to 20 years. And currently there is a gap between the current mining capacity and even the announced projects to expand mining capacity.
I think of the historical demands on fossil fuels, the environmental cost has been huge, and then you run out of the fossil fuels. What's the risk that lithium becomes the next oil?
We see electrification, you know, as a major lever for decarbonizing, in particular, road transport. And so, yes, lithium resources are certainly key to that. But there are a lot of innovations looking at different battery chemistries or ways to reduce the lithium content of batteries. And so I think, you know, our real focus isn't just on the lithium availability, but the supply chain to provide lithium and build the EV batteries that we'll need for the clean energy transition.
What does that supply chain look like right now? Why does it feel so fragile to you?
You know, the most notable thing about the supply chain today is that China really dominates most of the supply chain. So you've talked about how Chile is one of the largest producers of lithium. But in terms of mining, China has a big stake in graphite mining, and that's part of kind of one of the key parts of the EV battery. And then upstream from that, so including mineral processing and the battery component manufacturing, as well as the battery production itself and EV production, China really dominates all of those currently.
Which region of the world would you say is most prepared to capitalize on the availability of lithium?
China's already really taking advantage of that. We see in terms of policy a lot of movement in Europe and the US to develop domestic battery supply chains. But, you know, in terms of physical resource, you know, lithium's pretty limited. I think only 3% of lithium reserves are located in the US. You know, it really depends on who's going to start investing in the capabilities, and China has a head start.
So my battery just died and I had to buy a new cell phone after 3 years. I mean, what occurs to you when you think about the demand for lithium these days?
I think, you know, a lot of our products today are made in a way where they're expected to just be thrown away whole, and then you buy a new one. But I think refurbishing, and then with electric vehicle batteries too, you know, you can have second life outside of a vehicle where the battery is still kind of serving a use. And then at the end of its lifetime, it's really important to start trying to recycle and recover those critical minerals.
Are batteries the ultimate solution to all of our alternative fuel questions?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think battery electrification really will play a very vital role in the pathway to net zero by 2050 or in any sort of decarbonization targets. But there are, of course, other alternatives. And I think I would almost warn against relying completely on batteries.
Elizabeth Connolly is an energy analyst with the International Energy Agency. She joined us from Paris. Elizabeth, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
We're all feeling it right now. Inflation driving up higher and higher the prices of everyday items. In Britain, people are talking about how the cost of living crisis is having an impact on daily life, including on something as simple as breakfast. From London, reporter Leo Hornack has our story.
There's a ritual that Londoners are familiar with. On a difficult morning or after a heavy night, a sacred go-to ceremony. The full English breakfast.
A full English is a meal. It's not a snack. It's divine. That is really divine.
And to do that ceremony justice, you need to come to one of its temples, a traditional London breakfast cafe known as a caff. A place like this.
As it happens, I was going to wait for you and I thought we'd have a breakfast together, so I haven't had anything yet.
The Polo Cafe by Liverpool Street Station. This high priest of morning feasts is owner Philip Inzani. His great aunt opened the place in the 1950s, and Philip's been offering full English breakfast to tired and hungry Londoners all his life.
Well, it's our best-selling dish. So we've got, I don't know, about 40, 48 dishes on the menu, and it's one of our best sellers.
Oh, and the tea has just arrived. Fantastic. Thank you.
It's got to be a cup of tea in there.
Let's be honest, English cuisine isn't universally loved. And I'm not going to convince you any different with this radio piece. But the full English doesn't need to be a complex cordon bleu experience to appreciate. It's food for the people. Simple enough to make at home, but rich enough for a true master like Philip to raise to an art form. If you're on a diet, this is your trigger warning. You may want to turn away from the radio now.
Yeah, so baked beans, standard baked beans. So the mushrooms, we roast our own mushrooms. So they're roasted with thyme, salt and pepper, and a little bit of garlic. Tomato, roasted tomato.
That's your vegetables taken care of. On to meat, or meats.
A sausage, that's a Cumberland sausage, so it's very strong with parsley. It's got a lot of herbs in it. Fried egg, that is the traditional. The bacon is griddled. Toast, that's sourdough. And then last, but by no means least, you've got the black pudding there, hidden in between the toast.
Black pudding, that's a savoury item. Basically a blood sausage.
So it's made now with dried blood. They put suet, they put fat, they put breadcrumbs in there and things like that. So I quite like it myself, but I can understand why a lot of people would prefer a hash brown.
The whole thing is presented on a single plate. The beans nestled against the eggs and sausage. The toast already soaking up the fat from the bacon. All for £10.50, about 12 American dollars. Like Philip said, this is a meal, not a snack. A carnival of fried food. There's a reason cafes like Philip's are also called greasy spoons. All around us, his regulars are settling in, placing orders, or hunched over plates and steaming cups of tea.
Can we do a full English? Yeah, with black pudding and give him hash brown on the side, yeah?
No one's quite sure of the origins of the full English as a complete dish. Possibly the 18th century, possibly even further back. And throughout Ireland and the British Isles, there are regional variations on this tradition. The Welsh breakfast has its own bread. The Irish, a different kind of pudding. In Scotland, you might find a tempting piece of haggis on the plate. But part of this grand tradition of the calves and their breakfasts is changing, just like so much else.
And what about the cost of actually producing one of these amazing full English breakfasts?
Well, it's obviously gone one way and it's gone up hugely, unfortunately. My suppliers that I've worked with for the last sort of 11 years, they're in the same dilemma as, you know, pretty much everyone at the moment, facing rising raw ingredient costs, rising fuel, etc.
Brexit, COVID, and now the war in Ukraine. The cost of daily life in Britain is rising for many reasons. And let's face it, for Philip's customers, a full English breakfast is not a good way to tighten your belt, financially or gastronomically. And that's beginning to put the tradition under threat. Philip's been getting calls from other London CAF owners.
Literally last week, I was speaking to a pretty close friend of mine who phoned me up. The bottom line is that he's had to close his unit after 15, 16 years. He knew the business, but wasn't making any money and therefore couldn't continue operating.
For now, it's time for Londoners like me to do our bit and support our local CAFs while they're still here. Not the worst assignment. My order's just arrived.
So get you another cup of tea.
Oh, I would love that. Yeah, cheers, thanks. All right, so here we go. Here's the full English. Tools of the trade ready. Delicious. Amazing. Long live the full English.
For the world in London, I'm Leo Hornack.
From the Who Selected This Music department comes this news from South Korea. Human error is being blamed for a politically charged moment at a rugby match this weekend in Incheon, South Korea. A team from Hong Kong was about to hit the pitch at the annual Asia Rugby Sevens tournament yesterday. Hong Kong is, of course, a special administrative region of China. Before the match, when the national anthems were played, instead of China's anthem, rugby fans heard "Glory to Hong Kong" ringing out across the stadium. A song that is strongly linked to pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. The tournament organizer said in a statement today, the incident was a simple human error by a junior staffer who downloaded the wrong song from the internet. An apology was made, but the Hong Kong Rugby Union has demanded an investigation. China has cracked down on Hong Kong in recent years with a strict national security law. That came after widespread demonstrations rocked the city in 2019 and 2020. Earlier this month, the federal government of Ethiopia and rebels from the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, signed a ceasefire after 2 years of war. Their fighting left millions of people in Tigray in desperate need of food and medicine. Despite the ceasefire, there have been delays in humanitarian access to Tigray, but over the past week, military commanders from both sides have met in neighboring Kenya to try to implement the peace deal. The World's Halima Gikandi is in Nairobi and brings us this update.
Representatives from the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front spent all day on Saturday hammering out some of the details. In a military building in Nairobi, Ethiopians who have been at war for nearly 2 years huddled casually in corners, making calls back home and taking cigarette breaks. By early evening, they were ready to speak to reporters. Former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is involved as a peace envoy.
The people of Ethiopia, wherever they come from, are in need of humanitarian assistance today, are in need of food, are in need of medicine, are in need of a resumption of services. And the responsibility to facilitate that lies largely with two gentlemen who are with us here today.
Those two men are Field Marshal Birhanu Julla of the Ethiopian National Defense Forces and Lieutenant General Tadesse Werede of the Tigray Armed Combatants. Both sides have led violent campaigns against the other that have devastated northern Ethiopia. But Field Marshal Julla said it was time for that to end.
We want to express our full commitment for bringing peace and stability to our people and country.
In the deal signed on Saturday, both sides agreed to stop fighting, to protect civilians and civilian infrastructure, and facilitate unhindered humanitarian access. Violations of the peace agreement, they said, would bring consequences. But General Tadesse of the Tigrayan forces said there are still big challenges to this peace process.
This is a very daunting task in the light of the many spoilers from within or outside, who are profiting from this war.
Those spoilers he is likely referring to includes Eritrea, which neighbors Ethiopia and Tigray to the north. Eritrean forces have actively fought in this war and committed violence against civilians, but the country did not participate in the peace talks. Still, the deal did mention the withdrawal of foreign forces. That's supposed to happen simultaneously with the disarmament of heavy weapons. The deal also discussed security guarantees for humanitarian workers. Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president of Nigeria and Horn of Africa representative from the African Union, said aid should resume immediately.
There are people in affected areas of Ethiopia, particularly in Tigray, in Afar, in Amhara, that are dying of lack of humanitarian access.
He said the humanitarian supplies are ready to be delivered. For the World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Here's a story that sounds familiar. A man is caught in legal limbo and left to live inside an airport. You might recognize that as the plot of The Terminal, a 2004 Steven Spielberg film starring Tom Hanks. It was loosely based on the real-life experience of Mehran Karimi Nasseri, a refugee from Iran. He spent 18 years living inside France's Charles de Gaulle Airport. Nasseri died this weekend of a heart attack at that very airport. While Karimi Nasseri's experience was extreme, it's not unique. Many people across the globe experience statelessness. Omal Techikara joins us to discuss this problem we hear so little about. He's the co-director of the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion and is in London. Omal, roughly how many people are stateless today? Do we have a number?
That's a really good question, and there's no straightforward answer to that. And that in itself reflects the hidden nature of statelessness as an issue. Many stateless people are undocumented. Many states don't maintain statistics on statelessness, and indeed, sometimes there are political incentives to underreport or undercount stateless people. And so our organization has pieced together different groups of statistics, and we've come up with an estimate of at least 15 million people in the world, and you would find stateless people in every single country in the world.
And just for definition, what does it mean to be stateless? Is it simply the lack of a passport, or is there more to it?
It's not quite the lack of a passport. A stateless person is someone who's not recognized as a citizen by any state under the operation of its law. And this basically means someone who hasn't been able to acquire, or in most cases has been denied or deprived of their citizenship, and they don't have the citizenship of any country.
So you gave a guesstimate of some 15 million people. Where are they all, and what places absorb them?
So statelessness is mainly caused by discrimination, largely motivated by racism, by xenophobia. And so what you find is that the bulk of this 15 million estimate is made up of large communities who have been made stateless because the state does not see them as belonging to the country and has taken certain measures to exclude them. And so you would find large stateless communities in Myanmar, for example. You have the Rohingya community, a few million people who are stateless. So it's truly a global issue, but it also impacts people who are political dissidents, who are suspected terrorists. It impacts women in a particular way because 25 countries, that's one-eighth of the countries in the world, deny women equal rights to pass citizenship onto their children. So it's quite a complex issue, and it impacts a whole range of people in very debilitating ways.
Amal, in 2014, the UN launched a campaign to eliminate statelessness in a decade by 2024, and we're fast approaching that deadline. Is the world anywhere close to approaching that goal?
No, it's not. And I think that what we have also found out is that there have been new risks of statelessness that have emerged. We've also seen how the COVID-19 pandemic has added to the risks of statelessness and also added to the disadvantages that stateless people face. So the campaign, if it's to be judged by the metric of are there less stateless people in the world today than there were in 2014, then I don't think you would be able to conclude that the campaign has been a success. But what the campaign has done very effectively is it has raised this issue on the political agenda of the international community, and it has focused a lot of attention, more resources, and more energy and commitment to address statelessness. So from that metric, the campaign is doing a job, and it's doing an important job.
We've been speaking with Amal Techikera. He's the co-director of the Institute on Statelessness and Inclusion and joined us from London. Amal, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.